Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 29th of January. We should have a really interesting hour. Maybe you know about this. The Senate Finance Committee has been concerned about the – well, a lot of people are – about the rising cost of higher education. And last week they demanded some information from the nation's wealthy colleges and universities, 136 of them, and how they raised tuition over the last 10 years, how they give out financial aid, and how they have managed and spent their endowments. Senator Charles Grassley, who's the ranking Republican on the committee, and this is pretty much a bipartisan effort here, said tuition has gone up, college presidents' salaries have gone up, and endowments continue to go up and up. We need to start seeing tuition relief for families go up just as fast. The committee has a central role in setting tax policy, and they've been pressuring universities to use more of their wealth for financial aid, and also there's a threat that would require them to spend a minimum of 5% of their endowments each year, which is something that that foundations must do. So we're going to look at this whole issue and have several perspectives during the course of the next hour. Lynn Munson is joining us, the first part of the hour, adjunct research fellow at the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. She is working on a book about the hoarding of tax-free funds in college and university endowments. She's also president of Six Consulting Incorporated, which provides education policy advice and research to clients at the state and national levels. She served as deputy chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities from 2001 to 2005 and represented the United States at UNESCO meetings in Australia and Japan, where she was negotiating guidelines for cross-border higher education. We welcome phone calls. I would imagine we're going to have a lot of them on this subject. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation in Milwaukee. Hello, Lynn. Thank you so much for being with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Let's start with your response to Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa saying it's fair to ask whether a kid should have to wash dishes in the dining hall to pay tuition when the college has $1 billion in the bank. We're giving well-funded colleges a chance to describe what they're doing to help students. Are colleges welcoming that?
Well, I don't think they're welcoming it. Unfortunately, we've already heard a number of complaints, which surprises me because every year the schools that have been asked by Senator Grassley to provide this information participate in an annual survey about their endowments. It's a survey issued by the National Association of College and University Business Officers, and it requires far more detailed information from each school than Senator Grassley is asking for. So I think his request is perfectly reasonable. It also is, though, unprecedented in that schools have never had really, had to. The survey I just described to you is voluntary. But they have never had to provide to the government, to the public, really to anyone, any information about what they do with their endowment, how they invested it, or how they spend it. Unlike private foundations, which, as you mentioned, are required to spend 5% a year, those private foundations are also required to issue annual reports listing each and every grant that they gave in the last year, how much it was, who it's to, and what it's for. Mm-hmm. But colleges and universities have these multi-billion-dollar endowments in some cases and don't have to tell anyone about them.
So Congress, it's within the purview of Congress to demand that information be released. Can they do that?
Well, they can certainly ask for it. Now, what the senators choose to do with the information is another issue, and I'm not sure what confidentiality issues there might be
right.
There. But yeah, certainly to ask for it. And the letter, of course, actually came both from Senator Grassley and from Senator Baucus, the chairman of the committee, who's a Democrat from Montana. So as you point out, I mean, this is a truly bipartisan effort.
Right. I was looking at some of the figures showing how much the endowments at some of the wealthiest schools have gone up, particularly the last year, and their endowments increased significantly just in a year. Somebody knows how to invest money here, or something else is going on, Lynn.
Well, the schools, and actually the increases are even a little bit more than what's being widely reported, because what's being reported is in the 17-18% range, and that doesn't include appreciation or new gifts. So if you look at the real true percentage of overall increase, it's actually been 23% for all college and university endowments in the country. That's not just the high-end one. That's all of them. What's happened in about the last decade is that college and universities have adopted a lot more modern practices with regard to the management and investment of their endowment money. This is a good thing. I mean, what they've done is they've decided to not take such conservative approach to investing. They've gotten involved in more alternative investments. For example, their investments in hedge funds overall have gone up from 2.8% in 1998 to over 10% today. So it's a good thing that they're out there, you know, trying to grow these endowments. My criticism, and the criticism of many others, is that they haven't put the same amount of thought and energy into thinking about how to spend these monies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the kind of the other side of the equation. So you build up the money, but for what purpose?
Mm-hmm. Well, that would seem a natural thing to do, right? That you build up the money and then you figure out what you're going to do with it. Why haven't they gone that step?
Well, I don't know. And one of the reasons, unfortunately, is that it's really become quite a vanity competition, particularly among the schools with the larger endowments, to kind of see who can have the biggest endowment. And it's a big badge of pride of the institution. Also, college and university presidential pay has come recently to become tied to endowment size and endowment growth. So there are a lot of disincentives to spend from the endowment. And if you look at overall endowment spending, it's now down to 3.9% in the last year. If you take out what they've spent on management fees for the endowment and things like that, and just the money that they've put toward running the school and providing things like financial aid, it's just 3.9% of the value of the endowment. It's incredibly low.
Yeah. We have seen some schools, and this is fairly recent news, Yale and Harvard, and maybe there are others who have announced large increases in undergraduate financial aid. Why did they do that? Do you imagine some of these other schools that have huge endowments will do the same? And should all schools who have healthy endowments be doing the same?
I think they should. I think that all schools with, say, endowments certainly above $1 billion, and there's 76 of them now, perhaps even above $500 million, and that's the list that the senator's letter went to. And there's about 141 schools with endowments at large, really should be very proactively thinking about how they can tap into really what is now the power, the buying power of those endowments, and put that to an educational purpose, either to enhancing opportunities for the students they have, increasing access, you know, what have you. But for the money to sit there idle, in many cases, generation after generation, isn't helping anyone. And as taxpayers, you know, we're really all taking a hit for it.
Yeah. Well,
because they're tax-free dollars.
Exactly. And also, you think of the number of people who are having a hard time going to college. They could use a little help.
Absolutely. They could. And, you know, in some cases, too, I've looked very closely because everyone likes to talk about Harvard, and I've looked at Harvard. They're the first one to come out, as you point out, with a new financial aid plan. They, to be honest, it was really just a PR stunt. It's what they're adding to their undergraduate financial aid budget is just $22 million. It's bringing it up to $120 million. $22 million is what their endowment earned last year in a day and a half.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
my gosh.
If you look at it in the context of their wealth, it's nothing. You know, I've looked carefully at their endowment. Private school endowment, 55% of the money is restricted on average.
Mm-hmm.
If you take 55% of Harvard's endowment and then you apply to that a 36% number, which is the portion of endowment giving that is restricted for financial aid, you know, in the aggregate across all donations to all colleges and universities, that leaves Harvard with a $7 billion pot of money within their endowment that their donors have given them and told them to spend on financial aid.
Whew.
The $120 million that they're spending isn't even a sixth of the average earnings off the $7 billion. It's truly a pittance. I think that Harvard's donors have basically told them, please, go free ride for all students. Throw open your doors.
Right.
And instead of doing that, they're doing what you're saying. So.
Why?
I think that the schools are, for some reason, tuition-free is a discussion they don't even seem to want to have. I've done some recent analysis and looking at, if you pick a percentage, like 3%, for example, if you ask the schools to spend 3% out of their endowments every year and dedicate that all to undergraduate financial aid, there's actually 12 institutions in this country where all students could be attending free ride, affecting 53,000 students. So we're not talking just Harvard and Yale, but also Stanford, Princeton, MIT, the University of Chicago, Rice, the University of Virginia, University of Pittsburgh, California Institute of Technology, Pomona College, and Grinnell College. Free ride if they would just spend 3% of their endowment toward undergraduate financial aid.
My goodness. Let's welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we are talking the first part of the program with Lynn Munson, adjunct research fellow at the Center for College Affordability and Productivity, later a columnist for Inside Higher Education, and still later the executive director of the Project on Student Debt. Let's start our calls with Joe. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a couple questions. The first is, why would someone like Bill Gates even give another billion to a Harvard who already has, you know, $30 or $50 billion?
I think that's an extremely good question. I mean, you know, when is enough enough, in a sense? I mean, Harvard and many of the other schools will say, you know, that they're saving up for a rainy day. Well, it would require a rainy day of biblical proportions for a school like Harvard to really need, you know, the endowment funds that they've already amassed. I'd say there would truly be no purpose in that whatsoever. Except that if someone like a Gates or what have you said, listen, in exchange for this donation, I absolutely want you to go free ride for all undergraduates. If you could force their hand in that regard, I would say it might be worth it.
Okay. And secondly, I just back of the envelope calculations, Harvard earns about $175,000 per student per year on their endowment at only 5%. $175,000, and the question is, how dare they charge tuition and Grinnell College, again, in closer to home in Iowa, they earn $50,000 per student per year, you know, at only a 5% return. And again, the fact that they're even charging tuition is astonishing.
And not only they're charging tuition, they continue to increase tuition, 5.3% at Harvard last year. In a recent year, it was 12% at Grinnell.
Wow.
At Grinnell, they have $1 million in the bank per student. You know, and Harvard talks about wanting to be free and accessible to all students. They're still charging a $65 application fee.
And they're justifying it by saying what? Surely people must be asking that question. Why is your tuition going up if you have this huge endowment?
Well, there are a lot of people who say, you know, why should you give a free ride to the children of wealthy people who might be attending these institutions? And I think they kind of hide a bit behind that criticism again because they're just afraid of embracing this idea of going tuition-free or free ride. You know, there aren't any good arguments against it, particularly when you look at the amount of money that's restricted in their endowment for financial aid. You'd have to ask them. I'd be very interested to hear what they would say to you.
Right. Well, maybe this request is forcing their hand on it, right? This from the Senate Finance Committee, will we get the answers?
You know, I would hope so. We'll have to see how straightforward those answers are when they arrive.
Right. Yeah. Joe, thanks for your call. Bill is next from Oshkosh. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi.
Good to talk with you this morning. I'm a retired faculty member who worked for many years in public universities, and I was a little concerned at the outset, although now you're naming a lot of names, that some listeners might be confused and think that public colleges and universities are in the same kind of boat and finance themselves the same way, and I can tell you they don't. And so I would really encourage you to emphasize that this is a segment of the higher education market that's limited to private colleges and universities for the most part.
But there are some public universities in this, aren't there? Lynn?
Yeah, the University of Michigan
right.
has a $7 billion endowment. It went up 25% last year. Texas A&M has a $6.6 billion endowment. And the University of Texas system actually has the fifth largest endowment in the country at $15.6 billion. And they, I applied those restricted for financial aid percentages to the UT system. They have $4.2 billion approximately in their endowment that donors have asked them to spend on aid.
Hmm.
So even though they have over 140
students. You know, the exception rather than the rule. And the other thing that I wanted to mention as someone who worked as a faculty member for many, many years is somehow this never translates to improve faculty salaries, particularly in the public sector, where Wisconsin faculty are way behind their peer institutions in other part of the country. So it's not just the students, I think, that are getting shortchanged, and I think they often are, but also the people who actually deliver the education are getting shortchanged as well. And I think both public and private, the issue of following the private sector CEO model is causing a lot of us a lot of concern, in which the heads, the administrative heads of many of these institutions are being paid enormously greater percentages than the people doing the work.
And certainly the Senate Finance Committee pointed to just that, in addition to their list of concerns here, right, Lynn?
Yes, they did. I mean, they asked, for example, for information on any kind of bonuses or tied to salary increases there might be for college and university presidents or endowment managers based on endowment increase, what have you. So they're specifically looking at that. I mean, you're right. I read just yesterday that there's over 100 college and university presidents in the country with salaries upwards of $500,000.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so it's a well-fed crew.
They could just set up their own scholarships, right, for all of the students who can't get into their schools.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, right.
You know, it is interesting, though, because about a third of the schools in the country with endowments larger than $1 billion are at public institutions.
Hmm.
So the public institutions are in there pitching in the big league. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. Lynn, thank you so much for all of your thoughts here. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, Lynn Munson, adjunct research fellow at the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. She's working on a book about the hoarding of tax-free funds in college and university endowments. She's also president of Six Consulting Incorporated, providing education policy advice and research to clients at the state and national levels. She was deputy chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities from 2001 to 2005, and we thank her for her expertise. We have several other perspectives on this and a ton of phone calls. Don't worry, we'll get to your phone calls momentarily, okay? Just stay with us. Joining us after we pause for a moment, Wick Sloan, who's a columnist for Higher Education and later the executive director of the Project on Student Debt, will be with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655. The Senate Finance Committee last week asked for detailed information from the nation's 136 wealthiest colleges and universities, asking what they did with tuition, how it was raised over the last decade, how financial aid was given out and managed, and how they spent their endowments. There's great concern about this issue. It was a bipartisan demand here from Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa, the ranking Republican on the Senate Finance Committee, and Senator Max Baucus, a Democrat of Montana. And it provided an indication that the committee is not backing off on the idea of requiring colleges to spend more of their endowments. Wick Sloan is with us now, columnist for Higher Education. We'll be welcoming more phone calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And you can read his column on this at Inside Higher Ed. That's all together, insidehighered.com. And we thank him for being with us. Hello, Wick. Thanks for being with us.
That's my pleasure. My mother was, and her family are from Oshkosh and Neenah, so it's a pleasure to be in Wisconsin with your 11 electoral votes for this important discussion.
It's a grand state, Wisconsin,
yes,
is, and maybe we'll hear from somebody from Oshkosh as well. Should Congress be able to mandate how colleges and universities use their endowments?
I think the Congress, the answer is they should be able to mandate it because they have that right. I'm not sure it's necessary that they do. And remember that Congress is we the people. So what the piece of this that the question raises for me is that what we need to do is rewrite the U.S. tax code so it no longer provides these huge subsidies for the rich while penalizing the middle class and the poor. The endowment spending is one way of doing that, but I think that there are broader options that Congress and the Senate can take on.
And those would be what?
I think they have to look at how can we have a tax code that incents education, that incents citizens to get solid skills in writing and in math, the same way we incent people to build houses. The points that I have is we could do increased deductions for scholarships to benefit need-based aid, not merit-based aid. I've pushed that for many years and can't seem to get much interest. We could fix the IRA rollover, which is expired, but limit it to funding scholarships for need-based aid. I think tax deductions for expensive buildings at universities that have no intention of expanding their student body need to be shelved until we're educating a lot more middle class and poor people.
Interesting. Why is it we spend some time talking about these enormous endowments? Not all schools have them, but billions of dollars. Why is it that universities and colleges, you'd think it would be a part of many of their missions to open the doors to people of all income levels, why aren't they at the forefront of this?
Well, this is what's very troubling. My own schools are Williams College and Yale University, and I don't know. I think you've hit on what to me is a great failure of all of our educations for the last 25 years, that we have so many people in such a wealthy country who are struggling just to learn to read and write it and have critical thinking skills at a level for a job. It's a very difficult question. I think you have to ask them, do they really want to open their doors? Because if they did, the doors would be open. But it's very embarrassing to be a graduate of these places on that issue.
Yeah. And then you look at what's happening with so many students. They're just saddled with this huge amount of debt, which isn't right.
No, it's very bad. That's very important. The other side of the equation that I hope your show will keep out is that the cost of education, the debt right now is financing the ever increasing cost. There is no reason that college has to cost so much. It's based on a 4-year model, assuming that we all need 4 years for a degree that's left over from the 14th century, not the 21st. And we need to look at that. That's a piece of this as well, the cost end of it.
Well, and it's not 4 years for most people. It's probably 5 now,
yes,
right?
Yes, no, what better evidence could you have than that the model is broken, that people can't even get through in the allotted time because of finance and jobs and other responsibilities?
So you're suggesting, Wick, that the model would be what?
Well, I've just finished an essay that I'm calling Common Sense, after our friend Thomas Paine. And my recommendation to get discussion going is that the BA be declared, the bachelor's degree just be declared obsolete, and that we focus our national priorities on making sure that every citizen by the time they're 21 can pass the AP exam in English language and composition and in statistics. And I can't think of a more efficient way to ensure that our citizens have the right critical thinking skills, and then they can go on and take the courses they want. But this idea of 4 years needs to be put on the table because it's behind all the questions you're asking today.
So we get those skills by where do we get them? We go beyond high school a ways?
I think you could get them in high school. I think people of different ages. I teach at Bunker Hill Community College in Boston. Some people, you know, aren't able to get them till they're older in life. But just focus on a national skill base that gives us critical thinking skills that help us in our lives and create an argumentative republic, and focus on that, and if the institutions choose to help people meet those skills, then they'll get some support. But and again, I don't, not everyone can learn these things when they're 15. Some people may need till they're 22, so you have to allow for that. But basically, the four-year structure of a bachelor's degree is the unspoken cause of a lot of the issues that are piling up today.
Oh, that's it. There are some new ideas. Most people haven't thought about that.
Don't know. And again, that's what I hope people will start asking. But again, you have to, you can't, you need to start where you can start. And the benefit of this wealth pile up question that the Senate has raised is it gives us a chance to look at one easy place to start addressing that, and that's the tax code.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised when you look at the billions of dollars in some of these endowments, I'm surprised, Wick, that there isn't some kind of outcry among parents and students who are going to college saying, wait a second, you got a whole lot of money here. How can you saddle me with this kind of debt and saddle me with this kind of tuition when the presidents of your universities are making an incredible amount of money, and you've got so much in an endowment? I would think that there would be much more of a demanding change atmosphere, which I don't witness.
No, you've hit on the point that gives me my greatest despair for years. When I was a university CFO, I used to ask students if they were registered to vote, and that was how they could, at a state university, affect their tuitions. They didn't understand what I was talking about. I've asked Harvard students here in Cambridge, where I live, why aren't you protesting these things? And they look at me like I'm crazy and say, what good would it do? And again, this is what I find very distressing about the attitude of the students and the parents. And I do not understand why there is not just the outcry that you say. Mm-hmm. The good news is that in preparation for speaking with you this morning, I checked with a staffer at the U.S. Senate Finance Committee to see what the reaction had been, and he said that a lot of support was coming in from parents and from students. So that I take as a very hopeful sign. But there's no greater cause of the high cost of going to college than that parents and students are willing to pay these tuitions. That is as much of an issue as anything out there, and I do wish they would protest.
Mm-hmm. In what way? How should they protest?
Well, I think you can just raise it, write a letter to the editor, call up. Students could stand around could pick at a trustees meeting at Yale and say, why are you doing this? It's a mystery to me, again, why they don't. And I think what makes me alarmed as a citizen is it's not that they disagree with me. I hope people do disagree with me and that they're people with better ideas than mine, but they don't understand why a protest would be appropriate, relevant, and they don't believe that it would work.
We're going to welcome phone calls now, and I think Wick will get more than a few of them. Wick Sloan, a columnist for Inside Higher Ed, and he's also a professor at Bunker Hill Community College. He joins us by phone from Cambridge, Massachusetts. And here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, 227-2050. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 227-2050. You can read his column at InsideHigherEd.com. We also have an email address that you can use, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. What do you think about all this? Have you thought about this if you're a student who's saddled with debt, or if you're somebody from a university or college and you think that the way things are is fine, or if you think there ought to be some kind of massive protest movement? to change this whole system. We welcome your phone calls. And we'll be back with them in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls now. And Steve from Wautoma is our first caller. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Professor, it's good to hear from you. I agree wholeheartedly with everything you're saying here. And in fact, my comment was echoing the first thing that you said when you came on, is that we need to change the tax code. And I believe we have so many extremely wealthy people in this country who, if they have $1 billion to give to Harvard, who obviously doesn't need it, they're not getting taxed enough. And if we can't count on the rich to do the correct thing, and if we can't count on these universities with these huge endowments to do the right thing, we need to tax them more, take away the tax-free status on the endowments, and tax them and give financial aid to the poor. I mean, but I think it goes to a bigger problem, how this whole country is being run for the rich by the rich. Now we have 1% of the population owns well over half the money in this country, and 10% own over 75% of the wealth. And it's just continuing to get more and more like that. The rich get richer, and the poor get poorer. And I've kind of lost faith that will ever change.
Mm. Well, I think I would respond. Thank you. I guess I would respond as, please don't lose faith, because democracy does work. I've run for office and been on a school board, and everyone I know who's tried something like this, you get mugged and beat up and all sorts of things, but you get quite a bit done. And I think the silence of many people on the issues of education is a bigger danger than anything Harvard, Yale, or Williams can do. And I think people have to write their members of Congress and speak out. And it won't always work, but you have to try. And it's that students aren't trying that alarms me the most. The other piece on yours, which is very important, is it's important not to get distracted in this debate all about the Yale and Williams and company, because at the end of the day, they don't have enough seats for everybody who needs an education. Mm-hmm. So I look at this debate that sparked as an opportunity for the nation to have the bigger conversation of, or how do we get the resources to the people who need a better education and distribute it more fairly?
I've got another quick question.
All right, Steve.
The other thing I thought about is that there are many more people now than there were, 50 years ago, and many more students that want to go to college. How many more colleges are opened on a yearly basis? We have many more students, but do we have more colleges than we used to?
It's a good question. I have no idea.
I don't either.
I haven't heard of very many, but you're absolutely right on a capacity issue. Is that, again, if you look at various colleges, they aren't expanding. Grinnell, that you were talking about a moment ago on your show before I came on, is the money goes, their wealth keeps increasing, but they don't have any more students. Mm-hmm. The same is true at Yale and at Williams. Mm-hmm. So that's a puzzling one.
Yeah, it sure is. There are a lot of puzzling things about this. Thanks very much for the call. Interesting email that's come in from Barb. I'm a guidance counselor who sees students struggling to meet financial cost of college. I have a daughter who's a junior at Princeton. She chose Princeton over UW-Madison because it was cheaper. Princeton promised we wouldn't have to take out a loan to pay for education, and so far we haven't.
That's great. Princeton is not getting enough press in this debate, because it was 7 or 8 years ago that they first announced they were eliminating loans. And a lot of the other wealthy colleges were very angry at them and took no action. And Princeton is also adding a new college or two. So they actually are they're one of the only ones I can name that are adding a number, students to deal with the wealth. Again, it's not quite, they have a lot more wealth they could give out, but Princeton, I think, does get a gold star for leadership among this crew.
Mm-hmm. Roseanne is next from Wanakee. Hi, Roseanne.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. And I just had a comment to make. My husband is a Harvard Law School alum, and he has written several letters to the editor of the Harvard Law School magazine, and about the exact subject you're talking about. He feels like the students are being gouged, and the president is taking huge salaries getting huge endowments for the school, not spreading it out fairly to the students, but he gets nowhere. Nobody ever writes him back. The president never answers for how she can conduct herself in this way. He gets nowhere.
I agree with you. When I go home this evening, I go down Mass Ave, and Harvard Law School is putting up a huge hundreds of thousands of square foot new building by Robert A. M. Stern, the architect, and it's huge, and it'll be beautiful, but Harvard Law School isn't bringing in any more students to fill it. And it's all done as a tax deduction, which is that way. And I think you're expressing the point of that Kathleen mentioned before, is that there's not enough protest, so these institutions have to respond. They can get away with just the behavior you're describing, and that's very sad. So I think you have to keep at it. But again, it's a mystery to me. I walk past every day, and I've never seen Harvard Law School students picketing any of these things. And if you ask them why not, they look rather dazed and can't imagine why they should.
And then they should go out to have coffee with you, Wick, and they'll be up in arms, right?
No, they'll flee the other way. But it's just sad that the silence is what it is. But again, as I said this morning, the word from the Senate Finance Committee are that parents are speaking up. I would also suggest your husband, sometimes if you write to the college newspapers and say that the president isn't responding, the college newspapers on campuses, I also think, are unusually silent on this. I talked to the editor-in-chief of the Columbia University Spectator about, and he said, well, I have to admit, I don't understand university finances. And again, I was stupefied, but that's what he said.
Thanks, Roseanne, very much for your call. And tell me about congressional involvement here. Is the Senate Finance Committee drawing national attention to this in a way that it hasn't been focused on for a long time, would you say, Wick?
Oh, it sure is.
It is.
This has been a good week. I've been writing about these things for years, and it's been silent trees falling in the woods. And finally, it's beginning to dawn on people. One of the issues in communicating this and writing about it that is, you know, ironic and a bit amusing, is just that the numbers are so huge, nobody believes you. But the tax subsidy, the federal tax subsidy per student at the Ivy Leagues and the wealthy colleges like Williams and Grinnell is $20,000 to $30,000 per student.
Wow.
If you divide it by the number of students, and the IRS doesn't dispute my math, and the colleges aren't disputing my math, and then a student at a community college in Wisconsin is lucky to get a $4,000 Pell Grant,
right?
And nobody's protesting this,
right?
And again, it's not the college's fault. They're playing by the rules that we, the people, are consenting to with our silence. And that's what I hope your show can get across to people.
Also,
silence is the enemy.
Yeah. Also joining the conversation now is Robert Shireman, who's executive director of the Project on Student Debt. He's the founder and president of the Institute for College Access and Success, the Project on Student Debt's parent organization. He's one of the nation's leading experts on college access and financial aid, served as education policy advisor at the White House National Economic Council, in the U.S. Senate, and at various foundations and think tanks. And he's done a lot in student loan reforms, the creation of the Gear Up College Preparation Program, the implementation of the federal higher education tax credits, and other initiatives. And thank you, Robert, so much for being with us. Do you know Wick? Do you guys know each other or not?
I you're a hero. I know exactly who you are.
Well, I've enjoyed your writings lately and your proposals on this issue of endowments.
Yeah, thank you so much. You know, I feel like this is one of the wonderful things about a great producer of this show, which Rhonda is, but I feel like we're talking about an issue that's been around for a long time and there hasn't been very much discussion about it. Once people hear about this, they're going to be very, very upset, Robert. They're going to want to shake up the whole system.
I think that's true, and we're seeing that in the news coverage. There's the difficult question of what exactly to do about it, because as Wick mentioned, these colleges are raising money like like any quote charity is supposed to be raising money, mm-hmm. and the rules don't encourage people to put their donations in the direction of institutions where the money will be used for students who have real need. You know, some of these there are thousands of colleges that don't have endowments as large as the per student amount at Yale, Harvard, and Princeton.
Mm-hmm. If you were going to give money to a school, could you say, and I wonder how many people who give money say, I want this money to be used to help defray the cost of education for somebody who's low income in this country. Can you do that?
There are certainly many contributions that are directed in that way, but because money is fungible, because it's easy for these institutions to kind of move money around, it's not hard for, not difficult for even these very rich colleges to say, your money is going to be used for these particular students, and they can simply take the money that they were putting toward that student's financial aid and shift it to something else. So it may make the donor feel like they are directing the money in a particular way, but it doesn't necessarily contribute to any greater amount of aid to a needy student.
Mm-hmm. And as we were talking earlier with both of our guests, Robert, the number of students who have phenomenal amounts of debt is amazing in this country, and they could be helped so much. Why should they have to struggle once they're out of school? And many of them do. They have two jobs, some of them have three jobs, and they have to pay off debt for years.
Absolutely. That's the situation we're facing, where over the past generation we've gone from a nation that, by and large, did not expect students to borrow to go to higher education to one now where two-thirds of those who are graduating have debts, and the amount they borrow has gone up by more than 50% after inflation. So we really have shifted and except at a few institutions where they have very large endowments and are able to provide to cover the full need that students have.
Right.
Kathleen, if I may, on
yes,
that
of course.
One, where the system is insidious, and the institutions I think know this is just what you've both just covered, is that by taking on the cost in debt that you don't pay till after school, you're out. You're already long gone from the people who ran up the bill, and you're paying to a third party lender that the college has sold the debt off to, and so people who don't, one reason with the lending is that they don't feel the pain of what they've just done until after the fact. So it's like deciding in a restaurant you want to send the meal back 3 years later. You can't do it, and that is a factor in this that can't be overstated, is that the pain of the cost doesn't hit the consumer at the moment that they're using the service.
Mm-hmm. You want to comment on that, Robert?
It's definitely true. I mean, we tell students that they shouldn't take out more debt than they will be able to repay. But what student as a freshman in college
right.
truly knows what job they will get and how much they will be paid and how fast their salary will increase and what the economy will be like? I mean, it's impossible to predict those sorts of things. So it's not a realistic expectation of a young person or an older person.
Yeah. Let's go to more phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. And our next caller is Pam from Hartford. Hi, Pam.
Good morning. Very wonderful program. I just wanted to mention that we have three children in college right now.
Oh, my.
Their own way. My husband went back to school later on after we were married and had a family already. And because of that, we, you know, can't help our kids, even though the government, you know, they apply for FAFSAs every year, and the government says, well, as your parents should be able to, contribute $10,000 to $12,000 a year per student. And as we've contacted, like, the financial aid departments at the schools, you know, they say there's nothing they can do to help, you know, the government understand that we don't have $10,000 to $12,000 to contribute to one of our children, let alone all three of them. None of them have received a Pell. luckily, from high school as seniors, they each did get quite a few scholarships, and we encouraged them to continue to apply for scholarships, but it's very disheartening.
Robert, you want to start? And thanks very much for the call, Pam. Robert?
Yeah, I wanted to. One of the benefits of what Harvard has done is that they created what is probably a more realistic expectation for upper middle income and middle income families in terms of what they are able to pay. And that may cause a review of the way that this federal method works, the way the federal formula works for determining need. It doesn't necessarily put more money into the system, which is probably what's needed more than anything else, but I think it will cause a reconsideration of that federal formula. But I'd say her kids are doing the right thing, and she's encouraging them to do the right thing, which is apply for scholarships. A lot of people stop with the federal form and don't apply for the private scholarships, and filling, writing that essay and turning in those applications sometimes results in a few hundred bucks here and there, and it adds up.
Sure it does. Wick?
Oh, again, that's the situation you describe is all too common, and I guess I look at these in my work is it's sort of two steps, is that I'll help any individual over the wall one at a time, and then look at the bigger system and see what we can repair, and individuals should look for the money, because it is often out there, and jobs and work study. In my expository writing class at Bunker Hill as a topic, I use financial aid for a research paper, because I'm always surprised at how little students know about what's available for them. So certainly the students in the system now are just going to have to fight, $50 by $50, that's unfair. But the world isn't going to change soon enough. In the bigger picture, we still come back to the cost issue of what we're paying for is financing a huge cost, which 4-year degree or not, I think is a lot higher than it needs to be. And again, this is where parents protest. The example we just had is the college, the college says we can't help you on the FAFSA form. Well, the college could help you by cutting tuition 10%.
Right, sure.
That's a piece of it that you need to ask as well. And that, that's the big picture piece. But again, we come back to this idea that in theory, education believes there's no price you can put on the quest for truth and excellence, so they can increase costs, and that's okay. But we're the ones who are paying, and we're not protesting that.
Yeah, and truth and excellence shouldn't cost that kind of money, right?
I agree.
Yeah, that should be free. Truth
Socrates
and excellence should be free.
Walked down the Stoa in Athens that didn't even have windows.
Let's go to Oroville from Madison. Hi, Oroville.
Yes, hi. Thanks
hi.
For taking my call.
Sure.
These gentlemen are discussing a facility or a benefit for mainly the middle class and upper middle class. But I'm going to throw a spanner in the works. The reason why we don't have good education is because the demand is not strong enough, and people are not willing to get out in the street and protest the way they protested for voting rights and civil rights. I've worked in different places. I'm a teacher, and I've worked in different places, including working with my hands. And I've seen Mexican students come from Mexico, only go to the eighth grade, and they can do math better than children who go to high school in this country. There is no reason why a child should go to high school and graduate and cannot read fluently and cannot do math fluently, cannot do math well. And the other thing is that the teachers, because they're getting paid better and better, are gradually separating themselves from the people they're supposed to serve, in the same way that the medical community is. And seeing that the people who are having difficulty learning as a population apart, the only solution for this problem is for a federally funded educational system of technical colleges and liberal arts colleges, the way India did it.
Okay, Orville, thanks so much for your call. We have about less than a minute left. Wick, you want to take that on?
I agree. And that's why I come back to, we should have a standard of what people need to know and manage towards that, not an indefinite number of years. And again, this is where you can take the tax policy and modify it for just those kinds of goals. And and the modifications needed, I've done the math, these aren't huge crises. These are modest spins of the dial. So we're not that far from being able to fund this. And to get all the people just described educated, there's money in the federal budget now to do that. I'd happily take the job at 90% of the current expenditures. You know, we don't need the other piece of the national debate that's difficult is that with Iraq, we have no more money to spend on people such as those who are out. And there's money in the budget now. It just needs to be moved from new unnecessary buildings to teaching math to the people we just talked about.
Yeah. Thank you both so much for being with us. We'll be in touch with you again. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
And our guest this part of the program, Wick Sloan, you can read his column at Inside Higher Ed. That's altogether.com. Robert Shire, Executive Director of the Project on Student Debt, also with us. What a fascinating hour, wasn't it? We'll be on this topic once again. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Good work, Rhonda, and for on-air production as well. And thanks for all of your calls. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.